Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What's up, Fungal Associates? Welcome to Completely Arbitrary, the podcast about trees and other related topics. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Alex Croson. And Casey's forcing me to introduce him.
No, you always do. Whenever I go too far into it, I usually cut you off. And I have to like say, oh, sorry.
And you get a stop. You get a glare from me.
Yeah, exactly. So okay. Now I'm getting a glare when I don't say anything. Alex, what am I going to do?
Oh, poor you. Introduce yourself.
I'm Casey.
Hi, Case. Wow, we started the interview, or we started the, I don't want to bury the lead. We started the episode with an argument.
We did.
Very rarely happens.
Well, I didn't know what you were doing. I don't think it was an argument. It was more of a figuring out what was correct.
No, we're mad at each other.
What?
This is the thing where if I'm mad at you, I have to make it seem like you're mad at me to justify it.
All right. That seems unfair, but all right. I'm into it. I'm getting bullied into being a bully.
Yeah.
There's something here. This has got to be like, there's some psychology here, I'm sure.
Let's talk about my psychological defects.
Let's talk about your psychological manipulation of me.
Wow.
Alex.
Okay. Is this really happening or is this like pretend?
Oh, pretend. I don't really want to talk about that. Alex, tell me, what are your deepest, darkest fears? Make sure you're recording.
I guess heights is up there.
Yeah. Oh, hey.
That's one of my more practical, like, more like kind of surface level fears.
Yeah. Like almost not of mortality, but of the potential of mortality.
As far as heights?
Yeah, because you'd be falling.
I'm honestly afraid when I get up to a high place, I am afraid that I'm going to fling myself off.
Oh.
I don't know why I would do that.
I
wouldn't. Yeah, I just start to imagine, like, what if I just jump?
Oh.
Is that fucked up? There's got to be other people who feel this way.
Yeah, I think there are. I think there are, because I think I have also done that. Like, I would just be curious, you know? Like, it's not that I'd want to die. I just want to, like, see the camera shot of what it would be like if someone threw a camera off and then just it just plummeted down.
Oh, God.
You know?
Yeah.
Just kind of think that would be interesting. But I have no desire to actually do it myself.
Yeah.
Because then, of course, the you'd be like, oh, I figured it out. Splat.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I'd rather just figure it out and be like, that was interesting, and then move on.
Yeah, I don't have any desire to throw myself off of a huge height, but I get up there and I'm like, I start thinking about it. Like, what if I surprise myself and just jump? That would be terrible.
Yeah, that would be terrible. That would be awful.
What's your biggest, like, surface level fear? When I say surface level, I don't mean like loneliness or like dying alone or like spiders, heights, those
like
kinds
that.
Of things. Yeah.
Every now and then I have to like pull myself back if I'm riding my bicycle about getting hit by a car. I've been hit by lots of cars.
Have you?
I have, yeah.
Okay.
More than I should really, you know, well, probably fewer than I really deserve, but.
Well, yeah, you deserve to be hit by no cars.
I'm sorry, Alex. I said it backwards from what you concluded.
Oh.
I probably deserve to be hit by more cars than I have been.
Oh, because you're a reckless rider.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't say reckless, just extreme. Historically, I've really toned it down.
I remember back in like 2009, maybe.
Okay.
You and I went for a bike ride on the Oregon State University campus.
Okay, yeah.
And you said, Alex, ride my fixed gear.
Yeah.
I very stupidly said, hey, sure. And I rode around a little bit, and I remember you saying, hey, you look great. You know, like you were my dad, like teaching me how to ride a bike. And then we went down a hill.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, where? I suddenly realized, oh, there are no brakes.
Yeah.
And you said, just, you're fine. I was like, Casey, it was like a bumpy road, too.
I don't remember which road this was.
It was the one, like, is it Franklin or something?
Yeah, like the big one that kind of goes...
like up into campus?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we were going down that toward, like, Callahan.
Oh, yeah.
The dorms.
Yeah.
This is getting very hyper-specific, but...
I think I know where you're at.
And it's a kind of a fucked up, like, it's paved, but, like...
It's a lot of potholes.
Yeah. It was like an earthquake or something.
Yeah.
And I was very mad at you.
I'm sorry.
For not telling me before. But it was good. You kind of forced me to, you know, do something reckless and scary.
There
and I I came out the other end with a little bit of adrenaline rush.
Hey, there you go. See, that's the thing. I guess that's why I ride bikes. I have brakes now, just to be clear. So
if
I ever have you do this again, you'll be fine.
Yeah, fixed gears, no brakes are a young man's game.
They are. That is true. It's a young man's game. And but now to this day... whenever I get back on the horse, oftentimes I'd be riding and like you hear a car come up behind you, like in its Ooh. Lane, you're not like, you know, anything. And then it passes. But every now and then I'm like, what if the driver is texting and kind of swerves slowly over into the bike lane?
Sure.
And I just have no idea. That sometimes jumps out at me.
Yeah.
I hope my mom isn't listening to this. I think she thinks that literally every time I ride my bike.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about it. I rode one of those like, Lime scooters.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
With Lily.
Uh-huh.
And we were being safe. We were just going down the road. Like it was fine.
Yeah.
But like a car came up behind us and I was like, if that car wasn't paying attention or just decided to speed up right now and like didn't know we were here, we'd get fucking hit by a car.
Yeah,
no helmet.
Get smushed. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you're supposed to wear a helmet. Oh yeah, I wear a helmet.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
I've fallen too many times to not wear a helmet.
Sure.
Yeah, it's very, very, in fact, I wear my helmet while doing mountain biking as well. And one time I kind of tipped over and like landed on my head in a way where it was like, I used my head almost to like stop my fall.
Ow.
Not yet. It wasn't in a way that was like really dangerous. I know it sounds awful.
Yeah.
But I was like, yeah, I'm glad I had a helmet right now because I was like, oh, I'm just going to go.
His skull broke his fall. He's fine.
Everything's good.
Well, Casey, you know something I'm not afraid of?
Alex.
It's talking about trees.
Oh, that's great to hear.
And this week, we've got a doozy, don't we?
Yeah, we sure do. We sure do.
Boy, I sounded really professional right there.
You did.
And the tree we're talking about this week, Case, I'm going to say this correctly.
You're going to do great.
Is the Woolamai pine.
Yes.
Yes.
And the crowd goes wild.
It's not the Woolamai or Wollamai.
Nope.
It is the Woolamai.
That is the Australian pronunciation, which I think is the best we can do.
And this, after all, is an Australian tree.
It is an Australian tree, one of the quintessential Australian trees, but not in the way that you'd think.
Hmm.
Interestingly.
Before we dive into this episode, I just want to say good day, mate.
Good day, mate.
To the Woolamai pine.
Yeah, I think Woolamai. That's great. Exactly. I was like, and there he goes right there. So, yeah, that's the thing. But I think we have to address it right off the bat. When we are in the United States and we're saying this word spelled Woollami, our pronunciation is Woolamai because it has an I at the end. The E just before that, it says and then the I at the end just has that I sound.
Right, which is E.
Exactly.
Oh,
so
what a mess.
Woolamai is the way that I would read it, just like on a piece of paper. I'd say, oh, yeah, Woolamai. However, in the place where this is from, they would pronounce it the Woolamai Wilderness. So the tree is named after the wilderness, which they pronounce Woolamai.
I see.
And that initially comes from an Aboriginal term, which essentially is why they named that area of the Blue Mountains in the first place. So do the original speakers of this word say Woolamai? Probably not. It's probably some weird corruption of an indigenous term.
Yeah.
And in Australia, they say Woolamai, and that's where this tree is initially from and initially named. So I figure we should go with that term. But every other person I've talked to who's not an Australian has said Woolamai.
Yeah. Okay. I say officially... From here on out, We're going Wollemi.
All right, we're going to go Wollemi. I'm going to skip it all and just use the scientific name Wollemia nobilis and just say the Wollemia.
Wollemia.
Oh, God, Alex. There's no fun.
Oh, I love stirring the pot. Well, Casey, let's imagine that you and I are walking through the Wollemi wilderness.
Oh, yes.
You know, it goes about as well as you'd imagine. And we come across some of these trees. Let's ID the Wollemi.
Oh, thank you. I was like, he's going to do it. Let's ID the Wollemi pine tree. And I was like, come on, dude. Do it. Oh, right. The tree is, there's almost not enough yet too much we could say about it.
This is interesting.
So what you're describing is finding it in a carved sandstone gully. That is
a carved sandstone gully.
Yes. Does that sound good?
Yeah, what a weird turn of phrase.
Okay, yeah, there you go.
Is that like a gulch?
That's a perfect description. Yeah, or really, the proper term would probably be canyon.
Sure.
And this is you found it in the Blue Mountains, which are west of Sydney in Australia.
Great.
And these mountains are pretty rugged. They're some of the most rugged part of the. I think it's the Great Transverse Range or something like that in Australia. Kind of cuts across the entire side or the eastern side of the continent. And it is a rugged place in that it has historically been sandstone. And then there's some volcanic action that kind of peaked them all with basalt. So there's this really weird geologic history. And they have been just inundated with rainwater because it's in a rainforest area.
Wow.
In Australia.
Okay.
So they've carved out, just like the canyons carved of the red rock in the southwestern United States, these really deep, super intense, incised canyons in the sides of all these mountains. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. They only found this tree 28 years ago.
Wow. That's modern history.
That is modern history. Alex, you and I already knew how to talk in terms of us being children by the time someone abseiled down into one of these canyon gulches.
Abseiled.
Yeah, I essentially think rappelled.
Okay, yeah.
And found a wild grove of trees.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So only 28 years ago?
1994.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a tree that found, again, 28 years ago, but it has something like 35 million years worth of history on Australia alone, but something like 80 or 90, 120 million years of history everywhere else in the Southern Hemisphere.
It is so wild to me that it could exist that long and be discovered and documented. Well, I want to be careful here.
Yeah.
Because there were people pre-colonization,
yes,
in Australia,
yeah,
who I'm sure were familiar with this tree.
Well, that is an interesting thing where yes and maybe not. The answer is like 99% yes.
Okay.
And that's because in Australia, like you're saying, the original Aboriginal people who live there and have lived there for so long may have come over not 20,000 years ago, like in North America, maybe not even 50,000 years ago. Some people are thinking that the first peoples who came there actually got there like 100,000 years ago.
Wow.
It's not 100% clear or sure, but easily 50,000 years ago is a conservative guess.
By boat, I guess?
Yeah, they came down from the islands up above, like Indonesia.
Yeah.
Very similar to people who have traveled almost everywhere in the Pacific. These big canoes, very intense seafaring people, initially came down, found Australia, and said, sweet, let's live here, and then started to burn the continent. They've been managing it with fire for tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where if you're listening to, or you're reading a book, you're reading Game of Thrones, or you're reading the Lord of the Rings, all these like ancient peoples who have lived for a really long time, they're like, well, 10,000 years ago, our fathers built this castle. The people, the Aborigines in Australia,
yeah,
50,000 years. Like the time that they've been interacting and living on this landscape is so mind-blowing that if they didn't know about this tree, it would be like unbelievable.
Yeah. Okay.
But there's very little history in their culture, at least that we have today, that says, what did you know about this tree? And some of the theories are that they knew about the tree, but they're like, it doesn't really, we can't eat the seeds. We don't really use it. It's so far up this really rugged, intense mountain that there's not really a whole lot of use for it.
Not a lot of practical applications. Yeah, I don't know how well documented things are in these Aboriginal communities.
I'm not sure either. I know most of it would be probably an oral tradition.
Sure.
But just like here in the United States, a lot of all that tradition was destroyed when colonists came over. So, and it's also one of these things where the people who are still holding these traditions still hold them very close. And the trauma that they have experienced as people is not gone by any means. Mm-hmm. So it has to be approached very delicately. So we actually reached out to some people, Alex. We'll find out about that later. And specifically asked them about the indigenous terms. And they were like, well, we can't really talk about it. We don't hold that knowledge. We are not of this culture because they've descended from the colonists. So they're very much trying to respect and work with these peoples to say, what exactly was your relationship with this tree? We only found out about it 28 years ago. And of course, those people are like, well, if you ask the right questions to the right people and you approach it in a proper way, someone's going to tell you, yeah, we knew about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. that's just to kind of like set the tone of this interesting tree thing that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah.
That is just the tip of the iceberg, Alex.
I can't wait to Titanic this episode. Crash right into that iceberg.
Straight into it. Oh, well, let's do it, Alex. This tree grows to about 130 feet tall. On average, that'd be about 40 meters or so if you're down there in Australia listening to this.
Medium?
It's a medium-sized tree. It's pretty good size for, a tree. I think it's you'd give it a good, like, yeah, okay, good thumbs up. It's a big tree.
You're pretty tall.
Yeah, exactly. Just a silent thumbs up. There you go. Now, the funny thing is, initially in 1994, they found a single grove of these trees.
Oh, wow.
With like 20 individual stems.
Okay.
Or more likely, 20 individuals with many multiples of stems.
Ah.
They grow as a bunch of basal shoots sometimes.
Basal shoots.
Yes, which are just shoots from the base of a tree.
Got it.
So redwoods do this a lot. A lot of other broadleaf trees will do it. Not very, but comparatively rare in conifers. Mostly only the oldest ones actually tend to do that. Now, when I say the oldest ones, Alex, I mean the most ancient lineages. So the oldest in geologic time.
Okay.
Not like, you've gotten to 100 years old, now you sprout from the base.
Sure.
Yeah. So I noted earlier that woolamai is, in fact, an Aboriginal term. That means look around you or watch your step.
Interesting.
Which is because the mountains they grow in are so rugged where you have to like keep your eyes about you because there's like so much stuff there.
Wow. Naming a place after the fact that you have to watch your step when you go there is pretty great? Hardcore.
I love that. Oh, that place is called Watch Your Step. Oh, why is it called that? You figured it out.
Oh, that's good.
So what happened? These trees initially are growing in just this small little grove. Like I said, there was the first one, had maybe 20 or 30 individuals in it. Then they found another one just kind of downstream, or rather upstream a little bit. And they said, oh, wow, okay, we found a second grove.
Mm.
And then only after decades of searching have they found two other groves. So I think there's a total of four groves of these trees.
This is a rare tree.
This is rare tree. There's like less than 100 individuals growing anywhere in the world that have not been planted by somebody else.
Damn.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
This is like, I feel like that's like you find it and you're immediately in crisis mode.
Yes. Like, right.
Oh shit. Okay. There's only 100 of these.
Oh my gosh, Alex, that is a prescient thing to think about, because that's what happened when people found them.
Okay.
So this is such an interesting tree that when we were, when I started looking it up, I was like, wow, this is like, these leaves look weird. And then I was reading things and like, well, the leaves look in a different way and they kind of grow out. They said they look like fern leaves or cycad leaves. And I was like, that sounds really fascinating. Then they were describing them in really weird ways. It turns out that they grow as like these big branches kind of come out, but the needles come off almost like it would be a pinnately compound leaf, but they're kind of not exactly that way. They're really, really strange.
Interesting.
The way that they grow is almost unlike anything that anyone has ever seen before in any living tree.
Wow.
And they don't drop their needles individually, like, say, Douglas fir would. They would drop them limb by limb. So basically, they would just say, I don't need this arm anymore, and they just drop that entire arm rather than the individual fingers on it.
So they wouldn't drop, like, a leaf as in a leaf that has leaflets. They would drop the entire branch.
Yes, exactly.
Why?
And this, I think it's that they grow the whole thing out, but they didn't develop the individual bits at each leaflet, in quotes, so that one could drop off.
Okay.
It's similar to a Don Redwood or an actual redwood, Sequoia, where it does the same thing. It kind of has these little tiny twiglets that grow out, and those have the needles on it. And then they drop that entire twiglet when they're done with those needles.
Just a big version of that.
Yeah, pretty much. This is like a massive version of that.
Okay. Exactly. I mean, that sounds just like a technique. I guess nothing really surprises me anymore. I'm just like, that's the way it does it.
Well, there it goes. Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
So, Alex, because none of these leaves drop individually, they kind of drop like big chunks at a time. If you're walking into this forest and you're looking around, it would look like there's giant compost piles like raked up against the side of these trunks because they just drop massive amounts of debris that just kind of sits there and slowly decays on the forest floor. But because the tree kind of has the most of its needles and foliage right over the main stem, just because they grow, there's more leaves next to the main stem because they have that single stem growing up.
Yeah.
Or one single stem, you know, with lots of individual shoots coming out. But each one of those shoots just has that one stem. Most of the needles are right next to it. So when they fall, they tend to fall close to the base of the tree.
Yeah.
You don't get too many that are far away. So it looks like they've been piled up.
Can I ask like a question about that?
Yeah.
Is that good for, I would imagine that's good for the tree, like nutritionally.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Because they would essentially get more decomposing matter closer to their root system so then they can
use like fertilizer, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's smart.
Yeah, it is. It's a smart thing, or it's just a necessity for this area.
Yeah.
We'll get into it a little bit more because these trees only grow in these tiny little places. I read a description. They're about the size of a normal size, maybe a largish backyard. That's the entire extent of the stand of these trees, or at least the biggest one.
No wonder it took so fucking long to find.
Yeah, exactly. It blows the mind. It's like 100 kilometers from Sydney.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, imagine going to the other side of Mount Hood from Portland.
Yeah.
And then finding a species of trees that you thought never existed or only found maybe potentially in fossil record, but no one actually knows. Wild.
That's really cool.
So the next thing, Alex, that of course you're going to see is the bark. You're going to walk up to the bark and you're going to see that they're covered in all these little tiny dots. Now, I called a gentleman named Ian Allen.
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, yeah, thanks for having me on, Casey.
Now, Ian works for the Royal Botanic Gardens, Sydney, and specifically works in the botanic garden that is stationed out in the Blue Mountains. And Ian has actually been to these groves, and he described the bark as being covered in cocoa puffs.
Yum.
Down there, of course, they call them cocoa pops.
Of course.
I spoke with Ian earlier this year, and I'll let him describe it a bit more of what this wacky tree looks like because he has actually seen them.
And I've been privileged enough to go into one of the wild sites and see them there. You know, before that, you know, the tree, like I mentioned, it is very similar in habit to some of the Araucarias. So, you know, all these pine, well, again, they're not pines, but the Norfolk Island pine, Bunya pine, Cook pine, things that grow from New Caledonia and up in the northern areas of Australia. And they have this, you know, they look a bit like a Christmas tree. They often have everybody knows them from, you know, there's plantings all around the world on beaches, like Manly Beach in Sydney has these very straight Norfolk Island pines. Everyone thinks they grow in a big single stem with this classic branch structure, but a lot of them actually put out basal shoots and have multiple stems. But the Wollamai pine is such an ancient one of those that it grows from the base and it puts up a stem, and then over time it puts out more and more basal stems from the, like, sort of clonal growth from somewhere. It's not a lignotuber. It's something like that. And for some reason, it seems after fire or after stems break or they're browsed by animals, it keeps putting out these stems. And the wild trees, the stems have been aged at 500 plus years old. And you know, you get these 40 meter tall stems, but they grow in the cluster of basal growth, and each plant might have, you know, 6 more, 10 big main stems, some up to 35, 40 meters. And then there'll be all of these other basal stems, similar to how the sequoias have all of that basal growth on them. And then if the top breaks out, you know, those, the hormones all unleash the basal growth. And there's some thinking now even that as those stems fall over, you know, these, and light gaps are created, the basal stems take off. And so the basal parts of the plant could be thousands of years old, you know, the underground parts of the plant could actually be ancient like that. But then these unique things about it, so that the stem and the trunk has this bark, which I'm not sure in the States, do you have Cocoa Pops or like a breakfast cereal? Yeah. Just like a chocolate milkshake, only crunchy. So, yeah. You know, and those little like cakes that people make called there's chocolate crackles or and it's like rice bubbles with cocoa cooked in, and the bark it looks like that. As the bark ages, it has this incredible brown nodules all over it. And it's so unique. You know, I can't think of a plant that has bark like that. There's things that are similar, but as these things mature, it's just amazing. And then as you go up, the leaves on them are sort of they're fern-like in how they look, but they're really like tough, leathery, really tough material. And when they're juvenile, they just have one plane of leaflets. You know, the leaves can be 30, 50 centimeters long. They're almost like mini branchlets. And then as those leaves mature, they start to sort of, they don't branch per se, but they form an arrangement of 4 rows of leaflets along them. And as I think you mentioned, as the tree grows, they abscise those from the stem. They sort of break off these, the whole leaf itself falls off with all these little leaflets, just like a fern frond, really. As they put on new growth, their extension growth in that apical tip, they put up a leader, and the leader gets this cluster of buds on it, like a little crown. And everyone sort of colloquially refers to it as a snow tip. They ooze a resin out of them, and they get this white resinous cap, presumably to protect them from predation or when things are, you know, insects or things that are having a nibble, maybe they ooze more of it. And to the point where the resin almost drips off them, but it hardens and it becomes crystalline. And for some reason, don't ask me how I know this, but it's flammable. Like, you can break bits of it off and hold a cigarette lighter to it and they burn. And, you know, it's just amazing. And all down the tree where there's little wounds or where some of these leaves have abscised, you get these little trickles of this white resin. Mm-hmm. And just, I guess, to me, and this, again, some botanists might pull me up on this because this is completely my just theories, is, you know, they're so ancient that they've just got all of these almost precursory evolutionary adaptations happening in them that as evolution's gone on, those things have probably been refined into the, you know, the more common species we all think of. And whether it's the basal shoots, whether it's this resinous cap, whether it's how the leaves and branches abscise and the cones form, it's almost like, you know, evolution's done its work and taken these species to it like evolved into all these other things. And, you know, you really do feel like just picking up pieces of it, touching it, looking at it, you're looking at this ancient otherworldly plant that doesn't seem to really have many other similarities to other things anywhere in the world.
Casey, as we've listened back to that section of your interview with Ian, I've been looking at photos of the Wollemi pine. Boy, oh boy.
It's exactly accurate, isn't it?
This thing is so strange.
It's the weirdest tree. Like,
I love it. Yeah.
Ancient beyond degree. And one thing that I really appreciate that Ian noted is the fact that it's like, it's almost like these are all precursory things that then evolution has now refined, so we don't see it anymore, because it's like, oh, no one drives a Model T. That was completely pointless. Like,
yeah.
Everything about it was fine then, but now it's way different.
Right.
So the cones, though, Alex, we didn't really hear much about that, mm-hmm. but it's no different. But the big thing that is unique about this tree and the cones is that it's in the family Araucariaceae.
Right.
The colloquially known monkey puzzle family.
That's right.
However, it is neither an Araucaria, a monkey puzzle tree, mm-hmm. quote, or a Agathis, which is the big one is the cowrie, which we covered a while ago.
Discuss.
So I had to read a book about this. I bought a book called The Wollemi Pine, The Incredible Discovery of a Living Fossil from the Age of the Dinosaurs by James Woodford. And I read the whole thing yesterday. I have to say, this is the quickest I think I've ever read a book.
Yeah, you crushed it, man. Nice job.
I feel very good. So this is what James Woodford says about the cone.
Okay.
This is how you can tell the difference between the two kinds of trees. So he says, when the cone is broken up, a trained botanist can immediately divide the Araucariaceae family using the following rules. If the ovule sits on top of the scale, if one side of the seed has a wing, and if the exterior of the cone is smooth, then it's Agathis. Think of our cowrie cone that we sent out in the Cone of the Month Club a few months ago.
So far, this reads like erotic tree fiction.
Oh, it gets so much better, Alex. If the ovule is embedded into the scale, sorry, let me say that again.
Mm.
If the ovule is embedded in the scale,
uh-huh.
if the seeds are not winged, and if the leaves are sharply pointed, then the tree's an Araucaria.
Oh my God.
Woo! That's some hot stuff.
What then?
James. So the cone of the Wollemia, our Wollemi pine, mm-hmm. quote unquote pine.
Right.
It's not a real pine, people.
No.
Thank you. This has cones that from the outside look like Araucaria. They look like monkey puzzle cones.
Yes.
But from the inside, they look like Agathis cones.
I see.
But they're just so different that you can't actually place them in either one of those different genre without completely changing the definition of that genre. You know what I mean?
This cone is an Agathis in a monkey puzzle's clothes.
Yeah, exactly. And so everyone's like, this is clearly a brand new thing. Mm-hmm. We've never seen this tree before. Oh my God.
Very cool.
And they look just like that. They grow the very tip of the branches, and they just look like these, you know, there has to be, I think there's a video game character that has like a flame for hair.
Hmm.
Is this a real thing? Let me just be a better describer here. It's like you take, remember the bristlecone fur where
yes.
you had like all these long bristles that came out?
That's right.
Imagine cut those in half and then have them all kind of shoot out from a very circular ball shaped kind of Agathis shaped ball cone.
Mm-hmm.
But then they have just these long like flange things that just come out and poke out where it looks like a little bit of a porcupine.
Yeah.
That is what the cones look like. And they're maybe about the size of a baseball, a little bit bigger than a walnut kind of thing.
Oh.
And you would just see those, the tips of all these like new shoots.
Much smaller than the monkey puzzle cones.
Yes. Way smaller than the monkey puzzle.
Okay.
But they have that same monkey puzzle like kind of look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
It's a fascinating tree.
Well, the puzzle pieces are set out. Speaking of puzzles, let's put this bad boy together after the break. We'll be right back with more Completely Arbitrary.
Hi, everybody. Or should I say, hola a todos. I want you to hear something. It's this.
Yes, that is the sound of learning a new language with Babbel. You have, of course, heard of Babbel. You maybe even used Babbel. But if you haven't, Babbel is an app that helps you learn languages. Babbel is a science-backed learning language app that actually works. Let me put it this way. I knew somebody who used a different language app for 365 days and still could not even have basic conversations in the language they were learning on that app. Babbel is not this. They have quick 10-minute lessons and they're handcrafted by 200 language experts so you can start learning a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Because it's designed by real people for real conversations. In fact, a recent study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. And of course, the best way to learn a new language is immersion. You go and live in the place where the people speak the language you're learning. You speak to the people, they speak back. But the second best way is Babbel. And it's practical. It will very quickly teach you how to order food, ask for directions, speak to shopkeepers, without having to consult language apps while you're on vacation. And here is a special limited time deal for our listeners right now. Get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for Fungal Associates at babbel.com/trees. That's right. If you're listening to this, if you're a fan of this show, babbel.com/trees. Get 60% off your subscription. That's babbel.com/trees. Rules and restrictions may apply. Adios. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Hi, everybody. It's Alex here. And you know what? Come springtime, those trees are a-bloomin'. Those people are a-walkin' around. That sun is a-shinin'. And it makes me so grateful for my social life. People are wanting to do things again, and it can be extremely rewarding to start to see friends more often and, you know, go on cute friend dates or romantical dates, sit on a patio and drink a coffee, ooh la la. But it's really easy to overdo it. And for me, it's very important to keep an eye on my social battery. Every time I go on a social outing, I come home and I'm like, wow, I am really tired in a very specific way. Well, that's my battery. That's my social battery being drained. And I didn't really have this language until I started going to therapy. I didn't know why being around people made me so exhausted, even though I love those people and enjoy being around them. But therapy helped me with my self-awareness and helped me unlock some language that I didn't otherwise have. And if you are struggling with feelings and thoughts that you don't understand, therapy can be a great way to unlock the power of understanding. And a great way to start is BetterHelp. It's completely online and it's designed to be super convenient and flexible, which is very important. How many times have you had a therapy session on the calendar and that time rolls around and you think, I gotta drive all the way across town. I am not gonna go. It has, of course, happened to me. I'm sure it's happened to everybody who's been in therapy. No worries with BetterHelp. It's all online. And all you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire. You get matched with a licensed therapist, of course. And nobody nails it on their first time. It's like going on dates. You gotta find the right therapist for you. It's silly to think that the very first date you ever go on is going to be your future spouse. So you can switch therapists at any time, no additional charge. It's extremely easy. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/trees today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trees. Happy spring!
Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary. Today we're talking the Wollemi pine, Wollemia nobilis.
That's correct.
Very noble pine.
Exactly. And it's also named after a gentleman whose name is Noble. who was the initial person who actually found the first ones, who said, wait a second, this is weird, brought it back and said, people, what are these things?
How about that?
Yeah. So it kind of works out well.
Yeah.
Now, so Alex, let's see. We've been talking about this tree. It is, hold on. There we go. All right, Alex. So the big question that's on everyone's mind here is, why is this tree like this?
yeah, Casey.
And everyone has been trying really hard to figure this out, but it takes a little bit of sleuthing around to kind of think about what exactly was going on in the world over the past several million years that made this tree such an isolated hermit the way it is.
Yeah, I find it particularly interesting anytime we find a tree that's like a dinosaur tree.
Yeah.
And it's like it like found its place in this little crag in the ground.
Right.
And it just like camped out for like a million years.
Yeah.
That's always really fascinating to me.
Well, that's
because the urge to survive is so strong among these things.
It is. It's the urge to survive. And it's just maybe it's more like the urge to not die, I guess. If that's the same thing.
I think it's a difference of perspective, but yeah.
Maybe that's it, right?
Yeah.
So when we're trying to figure out like how this tree got here, the first thing that has to be noted is that it was growing across a vast landscape, historically speaking. And the main reason that we know this is because, A, the landscape was way different, and we found fossils and pollen of it. Rather, we found fossils of it and of pollen.
Oh, wow.
The pollen, though, because of the way these things work, remember when we were talking about the last most recent Araucariaceae tree that we've worked with, which was the rainbow wood.
Yes.
I noted that you can't specifically say that this tree is of the same everything as this other living tree. So if we find a fossil, we're like, it looks just like this living tree.
Right.
We can say it's very closely related, but we can't say for certain without like a DNA test, because some trees will look exactly the same in every way except one particular thing.
Mm.
Maybe that's growth habit. Maybe it's a species that has been separated out and speciated because of a mountain range or something. Think eastern and western white pine.
Okay.
If you found their stems, you would be like, oh yeah, it's one tree. But then when you find their cones, you'd say, oh no, these are different trees. When you find the pollen, they're different trees. And they don't interbreed.
Maybe ponderosa pine and longleaf pine.
Yeah, Jeffrey pine and like all those others. It's exactly, okay. You're 100% right. So in this case, they have found a bunch of pollen from a species they call Dilwinides.
Dilwinides.
Dilwinides. And that's spelled Dilwinites.
Okay.
So this is a pollen, and they don't have any DNA from the inside of it, but they found a bunch of pollen that has certain aspects of the outer coating, where apparently pollen is like indestructible, it turns out. And just like will sit there and the DNA will go away, but the like outer cell wall of the pollen grain just lives forever if it is not dissolved or burned or something like that.
It's really interesting to me that you can have a fossil of pollen.
Yeah.
It's like so small.
It is. It's so small. And apparently it's like everywhere. So if you just get a microscope, you can see it like nobody's business.
Sure.
And you can see differences in it where pollen from one tree looks like the same pollen from a very closely related tree, or the same tree, obviously, if it's still alive.
I see.
But there's like some that have just minute differences where you're just like, okay, this one are all slightly different, but they all are almost exactly the same in every way, except for like this thing is a little bit longer on these two, you know, that kind of thing.
A little extra nodule on this one.
Yeah, exactly. And so they ended up finding these Dilwinides all over the place, and then found the living Wollemia and was like, oh my God, this is nearly identical. Now, it could be that the Dilwinides initially was not the same exact species where it ended up changing and speciating ever so slowly over a million years. You know, just one thing evolves slowly into another thing just because of random variation over time. Then that could change the pollen ever so slightly. So then they would just speciate over a period of time. Or it could be that it was another very closely related species. Say there were four Dilwinides that were also very closely related to our living Wollemia, but are just so slightly different where now we have X amount of species. But some of those have already gone extinct and all we find is the pollen.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So this tree was growing just after Pangaea broke up.
Pangaea.
Thank you. I apologize, Dylan.
You remembered his name.
I remember his name. I got this. So when that whole continent split up, there's the top portion that became the Laurasia kind of sub-supercontinent.
Okay.
And then there's Gondwana, which was the southern kind of subcontinent. And that had Australia. It had big parts of, I think maybe was even somewhat connected in some way to South America.
Mm.
Or it might have just had a very small sea in between. But this is the thing. India and Madagascar, both a part of it.
Isn't wow. It, yeah.
India went from,
oh, that's right.
from Antarctica and then just went straight up and smashed into Asia.
Wow, what a glow
crazy.
Up.
Crazy. I just, that change, it blows my mind.
That's crazy. That's a huge amount of land.
It's so huge, yeah. And Australia is a similar thing, where Australia was once connected to Antarctica.
Okay.
This is back when there was so much carbon in the air. We were in what's called a hothouse time or hothouse climate. Right now, we're in a cool house or an ice house climate, which is really weird to say. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more in a while. But right now, as we're worried about global climate change and how much carbon is in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
The time period we're talking about, like 80 million years ago, you know, give or take some amount of time.
Sure.
Let's
be exact here.
Sorry, 80,572,000 million years ago.
In December, it'll be...
In December, it'll be 8,750,000. So back then, the climate had like 1,500 parts per million, when right now we have like in the hundreds or 200s parts per million.
Holy shit.
And that's carbon to the rest of the atmosphere.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That's insane.
It was so warm that Antarctica was a forest.
Okay.
A giant, covered in every possible way, vast forest. And not a forest that was like really like... not diverse, and it was a forest that had very few species.
Mm.
No. This is a forest that was a tropical rainforest.
Wow.
With swamps and insects and southern beech trees growing right next to all these different species of Wollemia and probably a bunch of other things. It's wild to imagine.
How things have changed, huh?
How things have changed.
I remember the good old days when Antarctica was a rainforest.
Yeah, everyone does. Just let's get back there as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
I'm going to go rev my car for a while. But it's wild to think about that this tree was growing all over the place, Alex.
Yeah, that's bonkers. That's a big... I mean, we've talked about like... was it... ginkgo,
yeah,
that just had like a huge growth span, yeah, like it just grew fucking everywhere. Is this similar in
it? Did yeah, and it even
surface
was growing
area?
It was growing down there too. Yeah.
Okay.
So imagine the entire. So a couple other different things I should add. The sea levels were like 1,000 feet higher.
Oh wow!
So everything was, if it was like lowland right now, completely underwater.
Sure.
All the highland stuff, though, was not underwater. They had all been smashed together in this giant landmass, and there were ginkgos there. Everything was just having a wonderful time.
Mm.
And over time, these trees colonized this entire space. Imagine like the classic like tropical dinosaur infested forest with all these big lycopods and giant ferns and all these weird plants that you just like when you picture, like I said a couple weeks ago, that diorama of nature with dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
That was this time.
Okay.
So fast forward, and the the continents of Antarctica and Australia split. There then becomes this current that starts flowing around Antarctica, and that essentially stops all the heat from going down, and it stops cold from leaving Antarctica and going up. And they call it the Coriolis winds, and they call it the Coriolis current in this area because it spins around the Antarctica.
So it kind of trapped the air there?
Exactly.
Okay.
And because of that, two things started happening. One, Antarctica started to get cold, and it never got warm again. Or rather, I should say, it hasn't gotten warm again yet.
You know what they say? It died of a broken heart.
It did. Australia left, and it was just like, no, I will become an ice king until my queen returns. It just stays down there. Yeah, that's sad. That's cold hearted. Yeah.
I mean, literally.
Quite literally. So, the same thing, though. Australia didn't get the long end of the stick as compared to the short end of the stick of Antarctica, because these winds are very dry. So they ended up causing what used to be a tropical wonderland to become now the second most driest continent in the world, second only to Antarctica.
Wow.
And that is Australia.
Oh my gosh. So they both got the short end of the stick.
There was, yeah.
Most of the stick fell into the sea.
Exactly. It's now down there somewhere, and someone's going to need to figure it out.
It's a fossil.
It is. It's a
petrified
fossil.
Wood.
It's petrified wood at the bottom of the sea, the long end of the stick.
That's right.
So the over time, you had this tree, which is this like really ancient conifer.
Mm.
It had everything going for it, and it was living in this great cush area. Slowly but surely, fires started raging through as everything started to dry out in Australia. So the landscape over time went from this tropical forest over the entire thing to the sea levels rise. The whole place gets bigger. These cooler and drier winds dry it out, and it becomes a huge desert.
Wow.
Or if not a desert, it becomes a fire-dominated landscape. Mm. And this fire-dominated landscape happened like 35 million years ago, or rather continued to happen over the last 35 million years. And you start to see this transition from all these Dilwinides and all of these Wallemia and all these other weird conifers that used to grow everywhere. They ended up having to get pushed into these tiny little refuges in these different really tropical, higher, way cooler, less fire-prone areas.
Sure.
Everywhere else turned into the Australia that we know and love today, completely covered by eucalypts.
We know and love. I would imagine, like, you know, okay, I guess I have a time frame question.
Okay.
I imagine all of this happening in, like, a 30-second flash animation.
Yeah,
you
sure.
know?
Yeah, yeah.
But really, we're talking about, what, tens of millions of years?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a slow change.
It's a very slow change.
And so things, you know, like the animals living on Antarctica or on Australia weren't like, whoa, what was that? I think we just disconnected from the rest of the world.
Yeah, wait, my friends.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like business as usual and everything changed.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming like a lot of the animals that lived, animals and plants, the flora and the fauna that lived in the, you know, pre-breakup era were like gone by the time we have the Australia that we know and love today.
It was like pre-marsupials. Once they got shanghaied on this island, which now we call Australia, then they became what they are today. And they kind of, the vast marsupial fauna kind of came into its own, and they adapted and evolved at the same rate as all the rest of the forest was adapting and evolving, turning into this more dry sclerophyll land, which is essentially just a fire-dominated dry landscape.
Sclerophyll.
Yes, sclerophyll.
That's up there for me.
Yeah, it's a good one, right?
That's a great one, yeah.
Sclerophyll. sclerophyll is coming. It'll take 3.5 million years, but he'll be here.
Sclero, comma, Phil.
Yeah, did you hear? Phil?
Sclero, Phil Sclero.
Yeah, no.
Phil Sclero is like a shitty, corrupt Florida governor.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So, you're right though, Alex. This is a long, long period of time. But the thing that happened is this one tree species ended up just getting wrecked from all these different fires. It didn't like fires. Mm. The drying is what caused it to basically leave all of these other habitats. And now it is only found in this one little teeny tiny place. And that place is to this day still in danger of fires.
Yeah.
And this kind of brings us to our next big question here is, as the climate is shifting, then what's happening and what is our responsibility as kind of humans, and what is happening on the ground right now that maybe we should be concerned with?
Sure.
Alex, did you know that when the colonizers came over from Europe to Australia, they did almost the same exact thing to the landscape that they did here in North America?
Sure. Well, yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense that that obviously would happen. The British did kind of both. Turns out that the Aboriginal populations in Australia, like we had said earlier, have been there for a really long time.
Yeah.
They have managed that landscape this entire time. It was already dry by the time they got there, and they started using fire to help manage the landscape, to help get rid of certain things and encourage certain habitats, and they also just were in balance with this kind of this whole ecosystem. As soon as the Europeans came over, they said, no more fires.
Mm.
We're not going to do that anymore. And we ended up getting this really intense buildup of fuels, and the same thing that happens out here in the West, where all of a sudden the fire regimes are thrown way off, and we start to add in climate change. And now we have this like intense combination of factors that create the situation that's kind of untenable for a tree that's like, I really like only wetland areas. So I posed this question, or rather talked about this a little bit with Ian Allen. So let's hear what he had to say.
We touched on the deep connection and ancient connection of First Nations Australians to the land. Well, it's widely known that the Aboriginal Australians managed fire in the landscape. They understood it in a way where they had almost harnessed, you know, the use of fire to manage the ecology and diversity for their food, for travel, like in a way that is just, it's mind-blowing when you're thinking of tens of thousands of years of their management of the land. Their evolutionary timescales, when you talk about a people that have been doing that for tens of thousands of years, the plants have evolved with that. And of course, Australia's 230 years old of white colonial inhabitation, and they essentially stopped that and stopped that fire. And just like what you mentioned about the United States, we've suppressed every fire. We've taken that fire management out of the land. We've built populations up. We've built in areas that were so fire prone. And then all of a sudden, it's like, we can't let it burn. We can't let it burn. And unfortunately, back in the summer of 2019, 2020, like what's happened in the west coast of America, almost the entire east coast of Australia burnt on the coast. And we'd had multiple years of drought. The whole state of New South Wales had been declared in severe drought. And everybody was well aware of the fire risk. Everybody had seen, you know, as the climate's warming, as these extreme drought and weather events are happening. But no one expected the scale of what happened to be like that. And unfortunately, all over the east coast, right up into these mountains and in the rainforest and everything, you know, things were so dry. And we just had that terrible coming together of drought, lack of fire management, you know, the buildup of the fuel loads, you know, these forests that hadn't been managed in a way where fires could be small. And you know, lots of agencies, lots of national parks, the fire agencies, lots of people had done a lot of work to try to manage that risk, but the scale of Australia, like the states, you know, you're talking about forests that are millions of hectares in size, and yeah, it led to these huge, I guess they now call it mega fires breaking out. And the Wollamai National Park, where the Wollamai Pines are, a fire started from a lightning strike deep within that national park. The agencies were unable to put that fire out. due to weather and due to the risks and everything else going on at the time. And that fire grew into what became known as the Gospers Mountain Mega Fire, which essentially burnt almost the entire Wollamai National Park. And, wow. You know, through the whole, the same fire and a bunch of other fires all linked up to become these mega blazes. It became known as what the Black Summer Fires, 2019, 2020, and lives were lost, houses were lost. But also the impact on these ecosystems was just incredible because of the severity and like intensity of those fires was mm-hmm. beyond what a lot of these landscapes have evolved to deal with. I mentioned before, you know, these deep rainforest gullies, it's rare that fire would ever make it all the way down into those with any intensity. But in that event, all of these deep rainforest gullies, it is amazing. You'd look into these areas and parts of the land that we manage on the Botanic Gardens estate, things that you never thought would burn, when you actually went down into them, fire had trickled all the way down into the rainforests, all the way to the creeks that are right at the bottom of these deep valleys.
Casey, I've looked up a map of the Gospers Mountain mega fire. It's an impressively huge amount of land.
Amazing.
I mean, I remember this happening. I remember reading, yeah. I mean, you know, it was like in the zeitgeist, there's fire, big fires in Australia. But I guess I never really, you know, I never really like looked into exactly how big.
Yeah.
This was a fucking mega fire, man.
Mega fire, to say the least.
Terrible.
Yeah. And this is all brought back to the context of this tree. And like Ian said, there's a lot of other things that happened and, you know, houses were lost, lives were lost and all these things.
Yeah.
But in the middle of this, put this unique botanical thing where the only groves of this tree that exist in the wild today, right smack dab in the middle of this fire, they all got burned over.
Mm.
Now, two things here. One, they were saved.
Yes.
They were saved. And if you want to hear that story, the rest of the interview with Ian, we're going to put that up on our Patreon. You can also, I'm sure, read about it. It was the single like feel good story of that entire summer for them. They were really worried, but they put in a bunch of effort and people got together and said, we got to save this tree.
Yeah.
It is so ancient and there's only like, you know, you can put the whole number of them in like a garage of all the living trees. This is one of the most important things in the history of the world, much less just us right now. So they ended up saving it and put it out in the news and people like went wild about it in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
They were really worried that everyone's going to be really upset, but it was like the one feel good thing that happened. We saved like this pride and joy of this tree.
Yeah.
But on the other side of this is thinking about the changes that Australia has been going through over the last several million years. This is potentially just another step in that area. Because, and this is the controversial side of all this, we're trying to save this tree and we're kind of playing God a little bit to say, how are we going to save this tree when there's also these like way bigger kind of transitions of the world that theoretically is the world going back to its more common state, which is super hot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of wild to think about like how much our impact affects such a specific thing. It's a lot to consider.
Yeah, boy. I mean, like, I'm glad they saved the trees.
Yeah, right.
But then you look in the and you're like, well, you know, okay, what's next?
What's next? Yeah. What about the next fire that happens, which could be very soon?
Yeah.
But we're gonna save that again for a talk on Patreon.
Yeah.
Where we're gonna kind of dive into the ethics of that a little bit. It's already too long to talk about it today.
Well, Casey, I think this is the perfect place to get into our review of the Wollamai Pine.
All right. Well, that sounds good.
And I'll just say up top, I have some strong thoughts on this tree.
Whoa, you do? Yeah.
I got some hot takes.
All right. Ooh, a little
too soon.
Too soon, Alex.
We're going to give some final thoughts on this tree and then give it a rating of 0 to 10 golden cones of honor. As our resident bushwhacker, we'll begin with you.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you. I actually will never bushwhack into this area. It is actually, did you know, the location of these trees, hidden, national secret level hidden.
Oh, I did not know that. So you nobody can just go hang out with them.
No, you can't. And if you do, you risk literally killing all of them. Yeah, they bring in a disease called Phytophthora cinnamomum on their shoes. So you actually have to like clean your shoes anytime you enter and leave the area. And they like make you sign non-disclosure agreements and put handkerchiefs over your eyes.
Yeah, blindfolds.
While you fly in via helicopter.
That's incredible.
Isn't that amazing?
It really adds to the mystique of these things.
Yeah, it sure does. So, so the Woolamai pine
woo,
is just one of the most extraordinary like survival stories ever.
Yeah.
It's like finding someone who's been cast away on an island for millions of years and being like, oh my God, you evolved into a different thing. What? It's like,
he's a frog man.
Yeah. It's a crazy thing to think about. But the one thing that I love about this tree is its gorgeous foliage. I think that the fact that everyone just compares it and thought that it was a species of either a cephalotaxis, people thought, or it's just another conifer. Alex,
okay.
Alex, everyone gave me this look like when you make a sound and dog kind of twists its head a little sideways. Like, what did you just say?
I knew you were going to go with that reference because it's exactly what I did.
Sorry, don't worry about cephalotaxis. It's kind of semi-related to a U. And it's like the Chinese U, I think is what they call it.
Oh, yeah. I can totally see this being mistaken for a U.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And so it looks a lot like other plants. It is not those other plants. And so I think it like has this beauty to it and kind of this mystique. Everything I've read about it, people walk up and they see it and they're kind of like their breath is taken away because it's like it's like going to the eastern United States. You're walking through a deciduous forest. There's just oaks and hickories and lindens and hornbeams and all these other like broadleaf trees. You see this gorgeous, okay, great. Then you come into a grove of giant sequoias and you're like, what?
Right.
Where did these come from? Why are they here? It apparently is so mind-boggling that it like takes your breath away.
Mm.
Now, if you did walk into an actual giant sequoia grove, they will also take your breath away. And here's where everything gets real. They have outcompeted everything else. They've done the same thing, but they're also like, if you punch them, they punch you back.
Yeah.
Where it feels like if you punch a Woolamai pine, they kind of like, and then that entire stem dies.
So, wow.
I don't know. I want this tree to be successful, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, how did you survive? Like, I'm a little suspicious of it. I'm just a little bit suspicious. Like, it's made a deal with the devil. Or
sure.
Something. And which is fine with me. I don't mind. It's sold its soul to like live forever, but it has to grow only in these certain spots.
Made a deal with the mayor of Sydney.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. When there's like a local hero in Sydney, do you think instead of giving them the key to the city, the mayor gives them the secret location of Woolamai's?
Here's your coordinates. Go see our secret tree.
And a helicopter ride.
Yeah, I hope so. That would be great. Yeah. They should still be blindfolded though, just to be clear.
Oh, yes.
So I'm going to give this tree, I'm going to give it an 8.9.
Wow.
I don't think I can put it up to a 9. Maybe I can. I'm 9.0, Alex. I'm going to do 9.0.
Wow, you did it.
I did it up there. I convinced myself because...
What changed?
Honestly, I think what changed is I haven't been able to see it, but I'm trying to imagine as hard as I can what it would be like to see this, like this thing that is so ancient where it feels ancient. Like when you see even babies in a lab, you're just like, oh my God, they're dragon eggs. Like I really think that's incredible. I can't give it a perfect 10 because a perfect 10 is a redwood and these are not redwood.
Fair enough, my man.
So that I think that's where I'd have to leave it and just hope that they will be everywhere very soon. And that is just going to be the way they have to live. But ideally, we won't make them similar to like the ginkgo where they're functionally extinct in the rest of the world, in their native habitat. But they're planted so often everywhere that they're certainly not actually extinct, but they're just extinct in the wild.
Right.
I don't want these trees to ever be extinct in the wild.
Okay. That would be like in Westworld, if all the real humans died, but the robots took over, but they look just like the real humans.
There you go. That's exactly, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to go with, 9.0.
9.0 golden cones of honor for the Woolamai from Casey Clapp.
Yep.
Okay.
Alex, what do you got? You said you had some strong feelings on this.
Yeah.
Are there any that you'd like to share?
I love dinosaur trees.
You know, they actually call this the pinosaur.
That's great.
Isn't that a good one?
I love that. That it just earned some extra points. I love dinosaur trees. I love the pinosaur. I don't understand why we... I think if I were to refer to this tree from now on, I would just refer to it to the Wollemi.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
the Wollemi pine.
Yeah.
Like it's a misnomer that's not needed. It's as easy as just saying, okay, we're not going to say that anymore.
Yeah, right? They just need a boardroom meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone in favor? It doesn't matter. I'm making the choice.
You just need a tweet from Casey Clapp.
Oh, man. Hold on. Let me go get my tweeter.
That says, we're no longer using pine in the name Wollemi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you have any questions, refer to this this news break. Not news break. What do they call it? A public
press release.
Press release. Thank you.
It's just a link to this episode of Completely Arbitrary. Yeah.
Can we make a press release for this? I think we should.
Sure. I got to Google how to do that. I love dinosaur trees. I think this is a really cool one. I love any tree that like grows in its own little protected bubble and like do not go in there and do not bring them out.
Yeah.
Just let them groove. They've been doing it for millions of years. And thank God, you know, sometimes we talk about something and I'm like, man, how lucky is it that we live at the exact same time as this thing that shouldn't, you know, even be alive.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about us and the Wollemi.
Okay.
Which I think at least earns it an 8.5 Golden Cones of Honor.
I think it's good number.
I can't quite go to 9. I don't know why. Maybe it's because they're Australian.
What?
I'm just kidding. I don't have a secret beef with Australia.
I was about to say, what is this?
Yeah.
All right. That's one of my favorite
television shows is Australian, Kath and Kim.
There you go. I think that's very fair.
I bet Australians listening to this just roll their eyes because it's probably a very like dumb show to Australians. But I love it.
Yeah, Alex, you do like a lot of these kinds of shows.
Yes, it's
true. I don't want to say dumb, but cringy, sketchy.
Sketchy?
Like of sketch comedy.
I don't like sketch comedy.
You don't like sketch comedy.
I mean, a couple here and there, but I'm not like a fan of sketch comedy. I feel like you're the fan of sketch comedy. You love SNL.
I do. I like sketch comedy. But you said what it was, You Have to Leave or You Should Go.
I think You Should Leave is maybe the one sketch comedy show. Oh. But I like watching individual sketches from it. I don't sit and watch it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I love
alternative comedy. I love absurdist comedy.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair.
Yeah. What? That was our review of The Wollemi Pine. Thank you so much to Ian Allen for joining us for this talk. A really cool perspective from somebody who knows these trees well, Casey.
Yeah.
And in on the national secret. That's pretty cool. Yeah. Casey, it's time for our completely arbitrary Q&A.
All right. Now, I'm excited about this. You asked me just before this if this would be a good question, and I responded, absolutely yes. I'm very excited about it.
I closed the tab for some reason.
Alex, why would you have done that?
Okay, this week's question is from the Patreon, as we have been doing, the Quercus and Alder tier Q&A.
That's right. Only $3 a month.
That's right. This week's question is from Kira Sears. Hi, Kira.
Hi.
Kira says, why, and I thought this one was very perfect for this episode, exactly. Casey. Why are Australian trees so weird? I'm a New Jersey native, and I've been in Queensland for the last few weeks volunteering with humpbacks. That sounds awesome. Why do half of them, Australian trees, have aerial roots? Why are she oaks so pretty? Are they even related to oaks? Is that throwing shade at oaks? I'm not totally sure.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't think so.
Like, why are you so pretty? You're not even related to the thing that's pretty.
Well, you know what? You should look up a she oak and...
That's not pretty.
Then I think that might clarify the question a bit.
I'm very interested.
Yeah.
They have needles, says Kira. Love the podcast and so grateful for you both. Hey, we're grateful for you. Okay, she oaks are grotesque.
Now, see, here's my other big question. Why don't the humpbacks pay a good wage? Why do they always have to like hire just volunteers? That's what I really want to know.
Oh, Casey.
I'm sorry. I just think if you're going to be volunteering, you sometimes need a little bit more.
We got to get you on Leno.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. This is such a good question. I think it's funny that it's like, why are they so weird? I think I just love that. I thought that was funny.
Yes, but I get what Kira is saying.
Yeah.
Every Australian tree we've covered, I've been like, huh, okay.
I mean, it is well known that everything in Australia is trying to kill you. So it is, it's not it's not out of the question that their trees and plants could be just as weird.
Sure.
So
just take a look at the rainbow eucalyptus.
Oh my gosh.
What
please,
the fuck is that?
You.
That's it's incredible.
Yeah.
But I've never seen anything like it. It's like out of a science fiction book.
The bunya is obviously this gigantic coned conifer that is unlike anything else. Again, everything in Australia is unlike anything else. They're great.
So, even the accents.
Okay. So Alex, here is my very first answer to the very first of those several question conglomerations.
Yes.
You're just not used to it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer, Casey.
Yeah. Whenever you're in a new place, everything kind of seems, for lack of a better term, foreign. Like, mm-hmm. You're just like, okay, everything is kind of a little bit different.
Yeah.
And the plants in a different place are part of that. You grew up in a certain spot. You're used to the certain flora or lack of flora around you. As soon as you go to a new place, you're like, oh my gosh, like going to the jungles of Vietnam are probably going to be like, whoa, why are these plants so weird?
Yeah.
Borneo, another example. Like, what is going on?
But somebody from Vietnam who goes to Portland, Oregon,
yeah,
might look around and say, wow, your trees are really strange.
These are so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of that, I think, just comes from a certain perspective.
Sure.
However, Australia has weird trees. Like, they're kind of above the fray in strangeness in a lot of ways.
That's a great Larry David when he says about the phrase "having said that."
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you can say anything after having said that.
Precisely. You know? It's just it's a catch all for now. Don't hold me too accountable
here. Yeah.
So Australia is unique in that it was taken away from this Gondwanan flora millions of years ago. And Gondwanan flora is weird if you are normally used to the flora of Laurasia, which is kind of the North America, Eurasia kind of world. So the trees that used to grow in one place when it was Pangaea. What did Dylan say?
Panegia. No, you always say Panegia.
Oh.
It's Panegia.
Panegia.
Thank you.
In Panegia.
Yeah.
Panegia had, it was one big thing. So there's, everything was kind of shared. But then when they split up, then the floras kind of kept doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then the floras in the north, if you're from the north, you kind of are used to them. You're like, oh yeah, pine trees, fir trees, oak trees, maples. Totally makes sense. You go down to the other side of the world, and now not only are they different plants because it's a different part of the world, but they've evolved differently for the last like 80 million years,
sure.
Maybe more. So you start to see that you can't even go and say, oh, that's a weird looking maple down here. It's a weird looking pine. No, it's not. It's not even, it's so completely different. It boggles your mind.
Different, different family, different order.
Yes, exactly.
Kind of deal.
Completely, completely new.
Yeah.
So then you go and take this other weird stuff where it's just like, okay, you are 50% of the flora that I've never seen in my life, then take that and put it onto an island, isolate it for several million years, and then let it just kind of get cabin fever and go crazy and turn into even weirder stuff.
Wow.
That's how you get Australian plants.
That's fun.
And also, like we said earlier, when this first left this giant, huge landmass, it was a tropical rainforest. Mm. Then it's been making this and has, for all intents and purposes, made a transition to a way more arid environment. So you essentially take these tropical plants and you transmorgify them into this new kind of desert related plant. And it kind of even adds a whole another layer of weirdness that comes with having a massive amount of adaptation for a whole new environment.
You know what we'll say about Australian trees, Casey?
What?
It's just a phase.
It's just a phase. They're going to be back. They're going to cut their hair.
Mm-hmm.
They'll start wearing other colors like beige instead of all black. Never sending them to college again. But the last fun thing that was asked there is about this tree called the she-oak or the casuarina.
Yeah.
Is that right? Casuarina? Yeah, casuarina. So casuarina is a species that looks like a pine tree. And I don't mean that in the grand sense. It looks like it has pine needles in the genus Pinus. But when you look at the cones in quotes,
aggressive air quotes, I would say.
Very aggressive, because they're not cones. And if they are cones, they're cones in the same way an alder has cones.
Sure.
Where they are actually more closely related to oak trees, which is why they're called she-oaks. They're in the order Fagales, which is all the trees that are like very closely related to the oaks and the beeches and the chestnuts and things like that.
I did notice it's a hyphenated name, Casey.
Exactly.
She-oak.
You did a very good job. See, this is the thing. Whenever you're looking at things and you can read the clues, you're like, okay, hold on. There's a clue here.
Yeah.
So the she-oaks in Casuariniaceae are this weird species of plant that now has just photosynthesized only in their stems, and their leaves are completely reduced to almost not existing.
Wow.
So the needles are actually probably more closely called, or more correctly called, cladodes, but I don't think they are 100% cladodes.
Wow.
Just to be clear.
We should do an Australian month.
Oh, that would be great, yeah.
Aussie month.
Now, these grow all over the place. They're invasive in Florida. I've seen them in the Philippines. Anywhere that's tropical, they grow like right on the beach, like in the sand.
Oh, wow.
So they're big timber trees. They're important wherever they grow. Yeah. Imagine seeing like a weird pine-looking like tree right on like a gorgeous like crystalline beach or coralline beach, rather.
Real aesthetic killer.
That's fair. That's fair. They do have a certain beauty to them, I would say. Yeah, you want palms, Alex? That's it?
On my beach, sort of thing.
All right,
or mangroves.
Fair. Okay, mangroves. Well, mangroves would be not a technical beach, but I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
You want that to be on the cusp.
I want it to be on the cusp.
Well, that's it. So Australia has weird trees because that's just the way they grow. They've had a lot to deal with, and they've done a very good job.
And we're not going to mention it to them.
I'm not going
to
say it out loud. They're going through a lot. Thank you, Alex.
As we said, it's just a phase.
That's just a phase. Casuarina, though, is well on its way to being a very weird, not oak tree. I don't even know where they got she oak from. I don't know where they got oak from. The fact that it is, the fact that it has a weird cone-like thing, and it doesn't look anything like an acorn, nor have leaves that look like oaks, make me wonder who came up with that.
A little imposter syndrome going on.
We might have to do a whole episode as to who done it.
I would love a she-oak whodunit.
Yeah, okay. Maybe
we could do like a clue thing.
Ah, yeah, axes. So I found here a piece of DNA.
It was Colonel Alder in the Arboretum with a hacksaw.
Oh, my God. It's disgusting. There's blood everywhere.
There's sap everywhere. See, we have to.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, sorry. Okay.
Thank you, Kiara, for your question and the great idea for this new episode.
Great idea.
If you have a question or an idea for an episode, join the Patreon, patreon.com/arbitrarypod at the Quercus and Alder. That's Q&A level. Mm-hmm. Or join the Arboretum for 2 bonus episodes a month about other related topics and trees, or the prestigious Cone of the Month Club, and get a unique die-cut cone sticker illustrated by an independent artist every month. Let's see. This month we have the Balsam Fir.
Really beautiful.
By Jocelyn Richards Daniels, a classic.
Upright cone.
They illustrated the Douglas Fir, Casey.
Yes, that's right. One of our most popular.
That's right. Hey, those are coming back. We're restocking the cone shop.
That's right. You want to get access to that cone shop? Get in the Cone of the Month Club.
That's right. Or
you can also get yourself on the next level, have a bi-monthly stream with yours truly, Alex and Casey, where we are going to talk about all different tree things. We'll take your questions. We'll have a nice fun time and do a live stream 2 times a month, one with Alex, one with both of us. And there's another level, the generous admission. If you just want to help support the show and get more things off the ground, you can join at whatever level you choose.
Yeah, boy. We appreciate all of our patrons, don't we, Case?
We sure do. As we go, do you want to know all the families and the Fagales?
Yes. Should I play some music to underscore it? All right, I'm going to put something here.
Betulaceae. Casuariniaceae. Fagaceae.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Completely Arbitrary.
Miracaceae.
We'll see you next time.
Nothofagaceae.
Goodbye.
Tychodendraceae. Completely Arbitrary is produced by Alex Croson and Casey Clapp.
Our artwork is by Jillian Barthold, and our music is by Aves and the Mini Vandals.
And you can support the podcast at patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
And find additional readings at completelyarbitrary.com. Thanks for listening.